New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Today, we'll be exploring the cosmic significance of dwarf planets with my guest, Allison Chester Lambert, who has a master's degree in cultural astronomy, astrology, and mythology. She was the founder of UK's Midland School of Astrology and the former resident astrologer for a daily BBC TV news show. Allison is author of Starry Messengers, Future in the Stars, and The Easy Way to Learn Astrology, How to Read Your Birth Chart. She has also created astrology reading cards and Greek mythology reading cards. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. This is Allison's second interview on New Thinking Aloud. She's joining us from Leicestershire, England. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Allison. It's a joy to have you back with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
And you know, it's a pleasure to be back. I'd love to talk about the things that we're going to discuss. I don't think there's enough talk about it in the online community yet.
Well, I'm glad that we can help educate people about the topic of dwarf planets. And to get us started, what makes a dwarf planet dwarf compared to other types of planets? And how did you become interested in these dwarf planets?
My interest arose actually because I was listening to a seminar by a very eminent English astrologer. There must have been about 50 people attending this live seminar. And somebody, Ixion had just been discovered. It was must have been 2002. One of the audience put their hands up and said, "What do you think about this? You know, they've discovered a new planet." And the astrologer concerned said, "All this means nothing to modern day astrology." And I sat there and I was absolutely amazed. I felt saddened, shocked. And I thought, well, if this, this very famous astrologer was not going to give credence to this, was not going to give attention to it, then somebody had to. Because it would mean that everybody would listen to this famous astrologer and go, oh, it means nothing. But I had already thought to myself, well, every single thing in the solar system has got to mean something, because you can't say Mercury has meaning and then we discover another planet and it hasn't got any meaning. Well, how on earth did the deity that designed all this work that one out? A few have got meaning, but a few haven't. I don't think so. The whole thing is connected up. And so I was shocked and I was horrified, and I thought, I'm going to stick up for these guys. And that's when it all started.
When were these dwarf planets discovered?
Well, they'd already decided that they were going to do some research in out there in the deep field, if you like, but the deep field of the solar system. And they had set up to start something called the Paloma Quest Survey, which was due to start in 2003 and I think go through to 2008. But they were doing preliminary work. They probably put their research PhDs, you know, on the preliminary work like they do. You go check the sky, we're going to the bar. But they were starting to get indications that there were big things out there as early as 2002. And it was because they were looking in a part of the sky that had never been looked in before. The assumption had always been that all the planets are on a plane, a level plane. And if you just keep going out on that plane, then you will keep bumping into planets, including Planet X, which is still out there, by the way. We're still getting those perturbations to Neptune's gravity. The Neptune's orbit, that means there is a Planet X out there. But anyway, so they were looking outside of that plane, the ecliptic, for the first time, can you believe? And that's when it all got very exciting.
Why are they dwarf planets versus considered regular planets? What is the difference between them?
Now, here you start a whole pile of what can we say, polemics in the world of astronomy. Oh my goodness, did this cause an uproar? Can you believe that there was no scientific explanation for the term planet? So it had never been, nobody had ever gone, well, what is a planet? Let's write down some of the parameters for using the term planet. It had never happened. Okay, so when they discover something which is not on the ecliptic, but looks like a planet, is it a planet? Now, here's where the war started, because you've got one side saying, yes, it's a planet, and you've got another side saying, well, wait a minute, you can't keep discovering planets at this rate, because they're going to have to rewrite the school books, right? This is going to cause a lot of money. There's a lot of things that have to stay stable in terms of education, and we can't have all this. So let's have, you know, they're not planets. Okay, so then they had to go back to the drawing board and say, well, okay, let's define planet. Can we have the terms which define planet? And after a very big meeting and a long, long time, the International Astronomical Union came up with the rules. Okay, it's called a planet if it is round, spherical, if it revolves around a sun, and if it has cleared its orbital path of debris. So when the solar system was coalescing, when it was first of all forming, and all the sun is like superheated and it's throwing out all these solid bits, and the solid bits are going to form into planets as they whiz around. If the orbital path has been cleared of larger bits and they've all coalesced together to make a planet, then that's a planet. If there's still debris on that orbital path, then it's not a planet. Well, you'd have thought that that would go, okay, like we've got it, there's the boundaries. But that just presents a whole pile of other problems, because what's debris? Okay, so is something this big debris, or something that big debris, or something this big debris? It just goes on. So you have to use common sense. Okay, I think they came up with the right answer to all this by giving a distinction between the planets that we have known about. You know, we've got eight that we've always been able to see with our visible through naked eye astronomy. But I think they made a sensible decision and said, look, if they're on the plane of the ecliptic, which they don't mention in the actual, you know, the terms describe planet, they didn't mention that, but anyway, just in case they found one on the plane of the ecliptic. But I think they made a sensible distinction, because Pluto is definitely part of the Kuiper Belt. And the Kuiper Belt is this donut-shaped ring around the sun and the other planets. But instead of being on the ecliptic, everything is off the ecliptic, all going at angles to the ecliptic. And Pluto, in actual fact, does that. And it was the first one to be discovered. The Kuiper Belt objects look like bees buzzing around a sun. They're not at all on that, you know, that orderly path, the ecliptic. Okay, so what are these guys? Well, the first thing to note is it is Pluto's gang, right? So in astrology, the astrologers count Pluto as being an enormously powerful procreator symbol. And, okay, that's enormous. So when we say that we've discovered more things like Pluto, we're actually saying, hey, we've got 5 more Plutos or 10 more Plutos. And that gives an enormous weight to the meaning of these extra planets. But I think they were probably right to give them the distinction of dwarf planets, because in meaning, oh my goodness, they are so much more complex, so much more powerful, so much more advanced in their meaning for the human race and for astrologers of the future, that I think it was the right decision.
Well, I'd like to get into the meaning of these dwarf planets in just a moment, but can you share, was there any insight from the discovery of these dwarf planets that provided more information about the formation of our solar system or any other implications from an astronomical perspective?
Absolutely, definitely. I mean, it rewrote the rule book again. And every single discovery of this magnitude rewrites the rule book. Our science has been quite sort of childlike and probably continues to be by comparison of what we're going to discover. But no, absolutely, it made big changes to planetary science. One of the things that has been really interesting about the discoveries is the gap in between the rocky planets around the sun. And then we've got the gas giants, so you've got Saturn and Jupiter, all of which are not solid, they're gaseous, although they have huge, huge circumferences, they are gas. When we get out there, we get into rocks again. And so to discover that many rocky things way out there, did change perceptions of possibly what was out there.
What seems unique about these dwarf planets as well is that many of the heavenly bodies, shall we say, have been named after Greek and Roman gods and goddesses. However, with the discovery of the dwarf planets, they got a whole new symbolic selection of names.
Exactly. And a really, really interesting question. And to be honest with you, one of the most important things to note about the whole quest, the discoveries and everything. I mean, for me, it was like discovering the new world, the Americas. It's got to be discovery on that size, on that level. It's an enormous, great big leap into complexity, into it stretches us scientifically, it stretches us in oh so many ways.
What are some of the examples of those names?
Oh yes, wonderful names. You know, they put a guy in charge of this called Mike Brown, who is from California, I think, and certainly lives in California with his wife, works at Caltech. And this guy is something of a maverick. He even stepped into the terrible place where he said, you know, I like astrologers. You know, I think astrologers, you know, have got just as much heart and love for the solar system as astronomers have. Of course, that caused a few problems, but he is a maverick, and he had some very interesting personal views about history and how it had gone. And he applied his deep thoughtfulness to the selection of names for these planets, and he did it with a great deal of passion. What I think he wanted to do, and this is obvious, is come away from seeing Rome or Italy as the center of the world in terms of naming planets and discovering planets. Okay, science might have been at one time at the heart of the Vatican because it could afford to employ them, but it's time to move away from that. It's time to diversify. And so what Mike Brown did was he looked at the indigenous races all around California. So you can look right across the Pacific and the Pacific Rim. And he had huge sympathy for these racers and their plight, really. I mean, we could say plight because we all know that terrible things were done when the West decided to expand and populate the New World. He named the new planets, gave them names according to a deep feeling about wanting to include the spiritual icons or the religious deities of other religions other than the Western monotheistic ones. And in doing so, he opened up a great big rich chapter of such complex and colourful spiritual colours that it gave us a huge wealth, if you like, of interesting spiritual thoughts and beliefs to come in and feed, really, astrological research into their meaning.
When we first met for your interview on New Thinking Aloud, we talked about cultural astronomy, and you used the term a few times, astrologia. Can you share a little bit about that to help us understand a little more about astronomy and astrology?
So they were both the same thing up until 17th century, 16th, 17th century. Astronomers were astrologers, astrologers were astronomers. So it was not deemed possible to separate the meaning of the solar system and the planets from life on Earth. Everything was connected. They couldn't possibly have thought about separating everything off and boxing it up. Astrologia is the name, or one of the names, that used to apply to that science. Astrology, if you like, that's, you know, a word that was around and used by, you know, the ancient people. Astrologia, well, I say ancient people, those from around 500 BC through to three centuries ago.
And what was sort of the pivotal moment that distinguished the two or separated meaning?
I don't know if there was a pivotal moment. I think there was a pivotal 50 or 70 years, something like that, as thought changed at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and Scientific Revolution and all the rest of it. Like everything at that time, science became mainstream thought, and magic in particular, and the sort of looking at things and seeing or predicting or forecasting, that kind of thing, was deemed to be not scientific and therefore not valid. And there was a whole, I mean, the sea change, if you like, the huge tidal change was about, oh, well, magic and everything else is sort of like old hat now and science is the new thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it happens in a day. I think that kind of cultural change happens over many decades.
Well, let's talk about some of the names of these dwarf planets.
Hmm.
Do you want to start with a favorite one?
Oh, do I have a favorite one? Do you know, I suppose if I was to have a favorite one, I think it would have to be Pluto, because Pluto has been around so long. I know Pluto so well. The others, I don't think I could pick a favorite out. What I did do back in the early days was I developed the meaning for the dwarf planets as a group. And I did spend a lot of time on that. And I can give you the sort of overview of that and then look at the individual ones. So as a group, I think what we need to do is look at the list of names that we've got there so that we know what we're talking about, if you see what I mean. Now, these are the trans-Neptunian dwarf planets because they are beyond the orbit of Neptune. But there is one that we have to go back inside the orbit of Neptune, and go to the asteroid belt for, and that is Ceres. Actually has the name of a Roman goddess, so that one did keep it short. But then it was named in 1801 by one of Napoleon's scientists, so we'll forgive them that one. Just looking at what we've got here, we've got Orcus with its moon Vanth, Pluto with its moon Charon, and then we've got Makemake, Haumea, Selacia, Quawa, Eris, Gongong, and Sedna are the current ones that are called dwarf planets. Just wanted to sort of get that list highlighted because people are saying, well, which ones are they? Then to look at the meaning of them. The first thing which can apply to all of them is they turn things on their head. They turn things upside down. They, looking at Pluto, they are, in astrology, they are incredibly powerful. So this is the astrological meaning of them. They appear also, all of them, to represent duality. They imply that life has something hidden, and what you see is not all there is. It's like we have a tapestry, a woven tapestry, and we have one side and we see everything. But if we were to turn the tapestry over, it looks completely different. You know, the wool and the cottons and everything look different on that side. And they have that feel about them that you can look underneath and there is something different. There is a duality. They all press for extreme transformation. Now, we're talking about transformation as in the terraforming of the planet, but probably the generative power of a constant evolution. So extreme transformation in the guise of constant evolution. This solar system isn't finished yet. It's quite young. It has a long way to evolve yet. They're all innately concerned with creational and evolutionary processes of mankind. And I guess not just mankind, it's also the evolutionary processes of our life here on Earth. We've got the global issues, which we're all aware of now. In 2006, when I wrote a book about them, nobody had even heard of the term climate change, global warming. None of that had ever been heard of. Now, when we think about that now, everybody's going to go, come on, this is silly. You know, 2006, we were talking about climate change. Oh, no, we won't. Check. Have a look. We were not. It's that recently that we have been put it on, you know, onto the table. So the global issues of and planetary processes, so things like weather and earthquakes, volcanoes, La Nina, El Nino, tsunamis, these all come in to the portfolio of dwarf planets, but they do so because of the terraforming, because of the movement, because of the evolution, because they are describing these evolutionary processes. And they also talk about population. So population shifts. So we've got and population inequality, population excesses, where the population has got too big. We could look at the Mayans, for instance. So the whole civilization got too big for them to feed themselves. And so there had to be a sudden decrease, a lot of starvation, famine, that population decreases to correct excesses. And so we get that, but also the thing about the inequality. Mike Brown bought in to the dwarf planets through their names, in every single case, some kind of inequality. And sometimes it isn't obvious. You look at it, you think, where's the inequality? But you scratch the surface and start to look at what that deity meant to those people, those indigenous people, and then you start to get, oh, there's the inequality. So that's the kind of overall meaning of them anyway.
Well, you mentioned Ceres. Do you want to begin there and go a little more deeply into each of the dwarf planets on their meaning and what was happening around the discovery, any other cultural significance or whatever else you would like to share about them?
Ceres, an interesting one, really, because I would now say that I would support something a little bit woo-woo, if you like, and that's really the rise of the feminine, which sounds as if I should be on the front page of, you know, one of the floppy magazines. But I definitely see the rise of the feminine as in yin. I definitely see that that is an issue which has started to really pick up pace over the last few years. You only have to look at the lockdowns. You only have to look at the issues to do with the pandemic, the viral pandemic, to see that the feminine energy must be gaining ground, because everything that is masculine is about growth, industrial growth, commercial growth. What happened during those lockdowns was everything stopped dead and actually pulled in, contracted. That's feminine energy at work. We also, you can see the rise of the feminine. Something else, I think it's the Suez Canal. Everybody will remember a Chinese cargo ship going along the canal, and then suddenly something happens and the whole thing is grounded and it blocks this very important shipping canal for a number of weeks. And again, stops all progress, stops commercialism. Car parts weren't getting through to Europe. Nobody could get their car fixed, this kind of thing. Before that, because of the Paloma Quest survey and the discovery of these other rocks, planets, because they were creating their own kind of gang, somebody looked at Ceres and went, well, in that case, you've got to include Ceres, because she is, after all, exactly what she has the physical attributes of a dwarf planet. So therefore, you've got to call her that. She's spherical, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so, okay, suddenly Ceres is important, and it was now I see it was the reconnection to Earth and Earth cycles. This was what was important. This deity, this energy of our collective, the unconscious collective, needed to be upgraded, needed to be more available. She represents things like the cycle of seeds, just plain cycle. So crops, or human seeds, anything to do with the growth of seeds into maturity, dying, and then rebirth, etc. So food supply, worldwide crop shortages, rising grain prices, these are all under the patronage of Ceres in astrology. The grieving process, loss. The grieving process is something that we had lost the ability to act out in a way that was the best way for us to deal with grieving and loss. We had got into a place where we wanted to sanitize everything, including death, and not include death and don't talk about death. And we needed to go back to a place where we did have a death plan. We have birth plans. Why can't we have a death plan individually? Why can't we talk about grieving and loss, that process? Why can't we bring it in, put it on the table, and stop trying to pretend it doesn't exist? Then she represents the parent-child connection and the parent-child bond. So that's the reason.
What culture does Ceres come from?
Right. Well, she was adopted by the Romans from a Demeter character, that kind of character, which existed in Greece. She was adopted by the Romans because they went into famine and they were struggling. The population was dying. And so they had to find the goddess that was going to save the day. And so Ceres, I suppose the name cereals, crops, it makes sense, was duly appointed. Mm-hmm. Now, shall I go on with them one after another now?
Please, yes.
Pluto we know all about, or should do.
Our viewers might not, so if you want to share a little bit about Pluto. Mm-hmm.
Pluto has the power of the atom, right? So we're talking about atomic power. And we're talking about symbolism, which includes the underworld, Hades, everything which is hidden. So dark energy, dark matter, recently discovered when compared to a lot of things, definitely Pluto's world, everything to do with what is unseen and hidden, but extraordinarily powerful. So everything, yeah, atomic stuff. Okay, in astrology, great power to move things, to be part of the process which move things to on to what they must become. Okay, now, along with Pluto on that orbital path, which is 40 astronomical units out from the sun, we've also got Orcus with the moon Vanth. Orcus and Vanth are really reflections of Pluto. There's no need for me to do a lot about adding anything more to that, except that choice of name and the choice of Vanth for the moon did do something. What Mike Brown included there was different religious thinking. It wasn't the typical religious thinking of the Greeks or the Romans. This was a religious thought, and this particular religion was moved over from Asia Minor, the Turkey area. They went along the Mediterranean, landed on the Italian coast, the Etruscans. We know now that the Etruscans actually came from what is now Turkey because of the DNA actually in chicken bones and cows and things. But the Etruscans had a whole new way of viewing things. They saw women as equal to men. Huge, huge difference to the Romans and the Greeks, who at that point saw women as of lesser importance than slaves. So the Etruscans, to bring in an Etruscan deity, Vanth, and Mike Brown actually thought that the name Orcus was Etruscan, and he chose it for that reason. But I was in email contact with him at the time, and I pointed out to him that actually Orcus was Latin, it was Roman, and it was not Etruscan. And he was disappointed because he wanted to have an Etruscan name in, but was happy to accept Vanth the moon as being Etruscan. Now, why did he want specifically to have something which was not Roman, not Latin? It was his choice again to look around and see, oh, look, there's this religion here. They're never given any airtime. They're never included in things. He always went for the guys that weren't included, the very fringe sort of areas of civilization, and in that way wanted to become a lot more inclusive in picking people or kith, kins, clans, from different to the mainstream. Then moving on from the Plutinos at 40 AU to planets that are orbiting at 45 astronomical units. That's the classical Kuiper Belt objects. So there we have Makemake and Haumea, and he took their names from the deities of the indigenous races around the Pacific. So specifically Haumea, Hawaii, and Makemake from, well, what we call Easter Island, but it should be called Rapa Nui. We know very little because there was some written material. There was some written material, but it was all destroyed by the Catholic missionaries who were taken over to the Pacific when the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, they were all sort of like land grabbing around the Pacific. And the indigenous people were treated extremely badly, and their beliefs were stripped out of their culture. Everything was burnt or destroyed, and they were taught the Catholic religion. we have very few precious pieces of any literature of theirs left. I think there's five pieces of wood with the ancient Rapa Nui way of writing and language. It's probably like hieroglyphs. It looks like hieroglyphs written on oars. So that they've got their writings with them in the oar. They didn't need to carry anything extra. Mike Brown chose specifically the names of creational deities there, involved very much in creating. And he did that because his wife was pregnant at the time. And he would go home every evening and he would sleep with his wife with his hands feeling their unborn child in her belly moving around. And he was so overwhelmed with creational, what they were creating together, that it became a very powerful motive for him, a great drive to include creation. He felt so much part of creation. It was something he couldn't shed. And I think we have to take that huge feeling and emotion and impulse that he had, and we have to look at that and work with it and say why. You know, this man was a mouthpiece, right? You know, he is the lightning conductor. where's the lightning coming from? What is it saying?
It sounds like he channeled the names of these dwarf planets.
I think he wouldn't say this, of course, but I think he was a channel where the, you know, deity, the incredible, intelligent, you know, creative energy or deity or whatever. I think he was a channel for something to get through, the information to get through, the powerful energy of the time just went through him and he made these choices.
Maki Maki and Humay are both creational deities. Is there any more you want to share about each of these from an astronomical or astrological perspective?
I think what we're looking at now, current day, is population shifts for whatever reason. The war in Syria, the war in Ukraine, and the Arab Spring before that in 2012. The Arab Spring caused a lot of population shifting. At the time when I'm going to call it an invasion, was taking place in the Pacific, you know, as the English and the Spanish and the Portuguese all fought for the land, I think there was population shifts, population moves. I mean, for instance, the boats would arrive and take as many of the islands as they could jam into the hull of the boat and take them all over to work on the sugar plantations. So I think, we are seeing now the population movements that these guys represent. And I think we are also getting a taste of, or getting a glimpse of, sympathies for those races or cultures that have been maligned, who have not been respected, who have been pushed to one side by history as it has been written by white European males. I mean, if we take Salacia, which is a goddess from, I'm sorry, but we are going to have to go back to Rome for that one. But when I looked at the choice of Salacia, I thought we were going to use indigenous character, you know, deities from all over, you know, the world, you know, unknown. Fancy putting Salacia in, that's just a Roman goddess. And then I looked into the story and I thought, I know why he did it now. So over in Greece, you've got the brothers for ruling the known or the mythological world. So you've got Zeus and you've got Neptune. And so they've got the underworld and they've got the ocean and they've got the overworld with Zeus. Okay. And so the Romans looked over at this and thought, oh, yeah. So they've got Poseidon in Greece, Neptune in Rome. Okay, now Neptune in Rome was at that point a god of horses and rivers, right? Nothing to do with the sea. Silesia, a female goddess, was the goddess of the oceans and the sea. So they looked over at Poseidon and said, oh my goodness, you've got this, you know, hugely important god involved with the sea. We've got Silesia. Okay. So Silesia was demoted and Neptune was put in her place as the god of the sea. So so of course, I suppose we recognize that now, because it, in the last few years, we are considering the place of women and whether or not they have had been subject to equal choices in terms of career advancement.
Yeah, definitely. In your book, you go into quite a bit of detail about Maki Maki, the god or force of what many of us know as Easter Island. What captured you about this spirit of Maki Maki?
The gung-ho attitude that he has. Very just grasping life and with all confidence, just taking it on. I mean, these islanders would do amazing things, you know, just, you know, jump on a small canoe, stuff some chickens in there, and off they would go, straight out into the Pacific Ocean, you know. I think their spirit was well documented by some writers in the early 20th century. There is also sort of a whole group or cohort of people, actually, called the baby boomers, born in the late 1950s, who have in their astrology charts, in their birth charts, a Uranus-Jupiter-Maki-Maki conjunction. So all three are in the sky together. And when you break it down and look at it, it speaks of a generation, so born between, I'm just trying to think of the dates, I think it was 1948 through to 1958, something like that. A whole generation of people who have what they call the boomers, the baby boomers, but who have sort of thrown out all of the stuff that their parents and grandparents wanted to imbue them with, to, you know, for them to take on, who became the guys that just broke everything down, broke free of the pall of the horrendous war, the Second World War, broke free of that, smashed it up, and reached for things that their parents were horrified by, like rock music and swing. And they changed also choices in sexuality, sexual preferences, etc. You know, that they changed the way that everything was done before, no sex before marriage, etc. I could see Maki Maki in his guise as a sexually generative character. He was a guy who was highly focused on the phallus, and who, as far as the islanders were concerned, there was a great deal of bawdiness about this as well, the phallus, you know, all sort of innuendo and jokes and things. And I think they just made fun out of the whole sexual thing of reproduction, having more babies to replace the ones that had recently been killed in a tsunami, for instance, that had, you know, taken over the island, or a famine or something like that. I think it's just this general zest for life that Maki Maki represents.
So we have a few more dwarf planets to discuss.
So the book that we've been talking about was called Starry Messengers when I first wrote it in 2006. I self-published and then it was republished by Findhorn Press as a different book called The Future in the Stars. When I was writing it, I wanted very much to give a baseline to astrology for these new planets. And I wanted to make up for that astrologer, the famous one that said that these discoveries had bore no meaning for modern astrology. This is my driving force throughout. And so I put the book together, and I included Sedna, who at that point it had been decided was not a dwarf planet. No way. This was an Oort cloud object. It was way too far out. It takes 10,200 years to go around the sun. That's like a really big orbit. These other guys take between 400 to 600 years to go around. But Sedna, 10,200? Nah, this is something from out there. Anyway, so Sedna got in the book because I needed to keep her in. I couldn't take that many words out. I've got to reduce 80,000 words. So, okay, I'll just leave her in. Anyway, to my huge surprise, about 5 years later, it was announced that, Sedna is a dwarf planet. What?
You were being precognitive, Alison.
So pleased that she's in there.
Yeah.
So it was lovely that Sedna should be included. And Sedna's story, again, she is married off by her father. This is from the Inuits, the Eskimos around the pole, the North Pole of Canada. So she's married off. And she's married off to someone who is not desirable as far as she's concerned. And so she tries to leave, and her father throws her over the side of the boat, and she tries to cling onto the boat and get back in the boat, and he cuts her fingers off so she can't. Dreadful. And her fingers all float into the sea and become sea creatures. At least they become sea creatures. So she has a torrid time of it as well, in terms of females being overrun by patriarchal characters. But anyway, so Sedna clearly representing the wild creatures of the sea and their plight, being totally overfished, treated so badly, but also brings in the female thing again. So after that, I'm just running my head through them.
We have E-R-I-S, Eris.
Oh, yes, Eris. Yeah, wow, one powerful lady. Greek mythology. So we're still in the Mediterranean for her, but this had to be the right name for her. So Eris is not invited to a wedding on Olympus, a very powerful wedding. And so she is absolutely incandescent. She has been left out. There's no way she's going to take this. And so she goes to the wedding anyway and causes a pile of trouble with the goddesses, and causing the Trojan War, which is this massive war which took like decades to sort out. And she causes a whole pile of trouble. And she causes trouble when we haven't done something that we should have done. So if you haven't done your updates and your computer breaks down and is invaded by a virus, that's your fault. So that's Eris energy. Now, you put Eris energy into anything, oh my goodness, it's like injecting it with testosterone or adrenaline or something. She was the brother of Ares, who was the god of war. So she's the goddess of war, if you like. Very powerful, very energetic, causes a lot of discord, disruption, a fire planet. However, the fire is necessary because it brings to the surface, or brings out into the open, things that should have been sorted out anyway. But it brings them out so powerfully. So there's Eris. I think that's it.
Oh, is that all of them? Okay.
I think so.
Thank you for explaining the dwarf planets to us. What significance do they have from an astrological perspective? So you as an astrologer, there are the planets that you look at, and transits and aspects and so forth. What weight do these dwarf planets carry from that perspective?
They have mounting value. Some of them have hit the ground running, Pluto and Eris in particular. Others, it is becoming obvious why we need them. I always say, you know, we don't need astrology to tell us that the future is getting very complex and very different. And there's a lot of change coming, but we do need an astrology to help us understand that and understand where the change is needed. And so they give us symbols to work with, symbols that are necessary as the human race grapples with the huge problem of overpopulation. We're going to have to spill out onto other planets. And we can see that from the work that NASA's doing. It is always about outreach. And we're going to have to do that because we are depleting resources. And there are so many people. There was a policy for a long while which came directly from the Catholic Church, of not interfering or not using anything that would help us reduce the population. So help women not to get pregnant, any kind of childbirth restriction aid. And that's caused an enormous blip in terms of the growth of the human race. I think we would have controlled it better had we, each woman, been able to decide. So if you're a woman in Africa and you can't feed your second baby, there's no way that you're going to put yourself up for baby number seven. You just wouldn't do it. But we didn't put birth control in the hands of the women. Had we done that, then I think we would have had different outcomes as to where the population is at the moment. So we have to have a correction. And I think these planets are about that correction. And I think, therefore, that it's going to take most of this century for us to recognize the issues and the complexities that these planets will help us deal with. They are metaphors for complexity. For instance, the issue of death, which is covered by Ceres. At the moment, it is illegal in Europe for somebody to choose to go somewhere and elect to die, to be given support in suicide. Now, there needs to be more of an open debate on this, because we're reaching a place with elderly people and the crippling diseases that we have, that somebody needs to put this on the table and open this discussion in a more honest way. And Ceres gives us a symbol for that, and also encourages that discussion. So these planets are, they're describing energies, and it's describing the energy of the collective. And so this is an energy in the collective. It's rearing up. It's coming to the foreground for some reason. Why? Well, because the population is huge and we need to find ways of helping deal with that. We need birth control for all women as a right, easily accessible, without any male overseeing whatsoever. Because put that into the hands of a woman, the right to get pregnant or not, she's going to get raped anyway, but put into her hands the right to be pregnant or not. These are very hot potatoes and hugely complex issues. These kind of issues cause a lot of problems in a lot of areas around the globe. It's complex stuff. And these are the guys that are bringing in the energy and saying, okay, you're going to have to discuss this now.
Yeah. I believe there are a few states here in the United States where physician-assisted suicide is legal. And my understanding is that it's quite a process to receive that assistance, but it is becoming more possible for the people who are interested in that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you just got to look at dementia, really. You know, I have a personal experience with dementia, there has to be a different way. There has to be.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of different, as you say, different thoughts and beliefs about that. And I appreciate what you're saying about these discoveries and some of these dwarf planets and what's happening really as a reflection, right? The heavens are really a reflection, or can be a reflection, of what we're all experiencing internally and collectively.
Exactly. You've just got to look, as I say, in 2006, nobody'd ever heard of climate change. It's like, look at that now.
Right.
It's hard to believe in 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
In 18 years, the difference, you know, into an unknown issue and what it's about now.
Allison, is there anything else you want to share today about the cosmic significance of dwarf planets?
I'm in awe of these guys, right? I'm in total awe of this energy. And I think it's because I am one of the baby boomers who does have Makemake conjunct Uranus and Jupiter. And I've also got, my moon is also conjunct Haumea. I'm excited by certain things, right? Science fiction, space age stuff, Stargate, right? Anything with a star in it, Star Trek. I have this massive fascination for it. I believe that the things that we have seen on our TVs to do with Star Trek, Stargate, etc., are there, out there, waiting for us. That journey will come. I absolutely believe it. And I am thrilled with the hope and the exhilaration and, wow, and what a brilliant journey it's going to be. I am sad that I won't be there to see it. Because I'll be, well, hopefully, you know, I'll manage to see a little bit of it, but after that, I'll just be too old. But I love the fact that it tells me there is a future, and it is a fantastic future. And, you know, we have these brilliant guys, scientists and stuff. Look at CERN, you know, discovering the dark matter, dark energy, you know, a whole different dimension to our life. And then look at the guys at NASA developing programs to go and live on Mars or the moon or something. This is all, like, for me, it's like, you know, discovering the new world, and then all these people in Europe get on boats and go over there and you know, start settling, you know, and colonizing. I hope we do a better job, because I think in some cases we have some awful history that we've got to make up for. But that's what I see these guys as powerful as that. And let's learn from the mistakes that were made, that Mike Brown was aware of and wanted to alert us to when he gave us the name for these planets. Let's not do some of this stuff again that we did so badly before. This time, let's go carefully and graciously out into other worlds, and there we go. That's what it means for me.
Yeah, I went ahead and took a peek at my own astrology chart, and I looked at the dwarf planets, and one of them, Sedna, is actually conjunct my natal Mars.
Do you feel strongly about the ocean and the creatures of the ocean?
I love the ocean. And I also, isn't part of the meaning that it wants to, like, help improve? I'm not sure exactly what, but doesn't it want to help improve?
I think so. I think there is something in the story there. Sedna said that she gave rules to the men that fished. I gave them rules and said, you can do this and you can't do that, if you must do this, da, da, da. So had she been listened to and observed as in a traditional goddess role, I think that we wouldn't have done some of the appalling things that we've done to whales, for instance. You know, we've taken some magnificent sea creatures and hunted them into extinction. And I think that Sedna is all for saving diversity.
Yeah, I care very much for animals and really all creatures of the planet. And that's probably one of the reasons that I help feature people like yourself on New Thinking Aloud, is to hopefully help make a positive difference in these directions.
Absolutely. I think that's an absolutely wonderful thing. And you've just taught me something, you see, about Sedna, because you're right. What I shouldn't have done is restrict that to sea creatures, because as I now remember, she has got a huge connection with birds, for instance, seabirds. But then also, yes, there was some spin-off mythology about creatures in general and things. So yeah, you've just reminded me of that.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, very fun. Well, Allison, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for all that you've shared with us today. And I know we're going to have another conversation in the future, going a little bit more deeply into the easy way to learn astrology from your most recent book as well.
Yes, I absolutely want to do that one. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you very much. You know, I have never had the opportunity of talking about these dwarf planets in this way ever before. And I have been on so many shows. I used to work for the BBC. I was on their BBC Two's politics show. I was their resident astrologer. And I've done so much all over, and nobody has ever wanted to have all this from me. So you're the first, and I thank you for the platform and being able to sit here and talk about these things in this way. Thank you.
My absolute pleasure, Allison. It is such an honor and my distinct pleasure to help you share all that you've studied and all that you're about here with us and all of the listeners and viewers on New Thinking Aloud. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Yes. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday.